All around us. With its flattering filters and highly curated content, Instagram's performative display can conjure feelings of anxiety and inadequacy, at least for me. But during the pandemic, I've come to see it more as a collective of vulnerable humans coping and trying to make the most of several awful situations converging at once. While self-isolating at home, I've actually been heartened by my Instagram feed. One account in particular has been a balm. And no, it doesn't involve photos of homemade loaves of crusty sourdough. Called Mod Texas, the page is a crowdsourced effort to document our state's many examples of mid-century modern architecture, a style that emerged after World War II that's often defined by neat lines and minimalist functionality-forward design. The account features stunners dreamed up by giants of Texas modernism, including O'Neill Ford's Tower of the Americas, built for the 1968 World's Fair in San Antonio, and the campus building at Texas Southern University in Houston, designed by John S. Chase, Texas's first licensed black architect. The posts that knock me out, though, display seemingly ordinary structures with extraordinary details. A wave-patterned breeze soleil shielding an Amarillo municipal building from the Texas sun. Charming diamond mosaic tile pattern lining the exterior of a defunct office supply store in Wichita Falls, a striking sloped rough roof jutting out over the mid-60s Corpus Christi Electric Company building. Helmed by Amy Walton, a Dallas resident who spent many years working in the nonprofit sector, Mod Texas serves as a collaborative trove of modern architecture, but also aims to heighten preservation efforts. An avid collector of eclectic mid-century touchkeys, including erotic kitchen dental items, Walton started the Mod Texas page in 2018 after attending a modernism event replete with a home tour, lectures, and a swap meet in Oklahoma City. I came back and said, well, who's doing this in Texas, she says. I had too much fun and felt like there were equally as many interesting treasures around Texas as there were in Oklahoma. Walton connected with local preservation and architectural groups in North Texas, gathering information on mid-century marvels as well as photographing and posting them. A modestly sized but active community of about 6,200 followers has grown in tandem with the page. Walton's post of an abandoned movie theater in Kingsville, for instance, prompted internet gumshoes to track down the building's historical details and commenters to share their memories of going there. Walton hopes the project ultimately spurs people to pause and acknowledge those places within their own communities. Any average person who loves the little dry cleaner in their neighborhood with the zigzag roof, we want them to take a picture so everybody can take a moment and appreciate it, she says. All you need is a phone and an Instagram account and a willingness to pull over and take a photograph. Through Instagram, Walton has also connected with architects like Ben Couch, a member of the Texas Historical Commission State Board of Review, and a co-founder of Houston Mod, a group that focuses on preserving and appreciating modern architecture in the city. Couch, who restored an East End home that became Houston's first protected modernist landmark in 2005, often chronicles his travels through architecture via his own Instagram posts. There's all this wonderful modern architecture in Texas, and it just makes you wonder, why aren't these places like Palm Springs? Why aren't they meccas of modern architecture, he says. Mod Texas also calls attention to noteworthy buildings in danger of being torn down. It acutely captures how the passage of time and shifting ways of life have rendered certain structures obsolete, such as a spectacular round bank off Interstate 35 in Bellmead near Waco. Opened in 1979, the American Bank building is slated for demolition this summer. The bank still owns it, but they're going to tear it down because no one goes to the bank anymore, Cash says. They're building a building that's much smaller to replace it. A little sidebar here, Big Boy's bandana. In 2013, Dallas resident Gary Izett installed a 7-foot-tall statue of mid-century figure Big Boy from the hamburger chain in his yard at the corner of Abrams and Trammell. Since March, Big Boy's worn a mask, just like the rest of us, during the pandemic. Back to the text. Modern architecture is still in its nascent preservation stages, given that buildings are not eligible for historic designation until 50 years after the construction. We feel there's a sense of urgency to protect these buildings because, one, they're just on the cusp of being considered historic, and two, since there was so much experimentation in form and materials back then, they can be more susceptible to time and the elements, Walton says. As I started going further down the Mod Texas rabbit hole, I realized that we don't always see what's around us all that clearly. Because of the pandemic, many of us are staying put in our own neighborhoods, so we have more opportunities to notice details we might not have otherwise. On a recent walk, I started picking up on instances of modern design everywhere, like a cherry red carport tucked into a cul-de-sac and A-frame houses stretching toward the heavens. And while running an errand in North Austin, I took a detour down Burnett Road just so I could drive by the cheery multicolored sign at Top Notch Hamburgers, a fast food institution complete with car hop service that's been around since 1971. During the months I've spent sheltering in place, Mod Texas has become, well, not a substitute for travel exactly, but a new way to channel that desire to go somewhere else. It acts as a portal both to places in Texas I've never visited and to familiar sites like the Jung Center in my hometown of Houston. I'd only ever seen the place while driving by, so I was struck by how beautiful the building's arches were up close in the Instagram photo. Much like our world right now, Mod Texas photos aren't devoid of loneliness. In fact, since people are rarely depicted amidst these facades, images evoke a sense of emptiness. Still, it's a small comfort to remember that these buildings have weathered much over the years. Surely, we can get through this moment, too. And still in state, we turn next to another section. This is food and drink. The title of this month is Three of a Kind. This is by Jessica Dupree. The column is entitled Summertime Booze. Some of the state's best bartenders share how to make their favorite chilled aperitifs. This first one is the Pegu Club by Bill Norris. He's known as Austin's father of modern cocktails. Norris has been slinging clever concoctions for nearly two decades. As the beverage director for Alamo Drafthouse's 40-plus locations, he's also helped develop numerous bar concepts, including downtown's Midnight Cowboy. This summer, he's pouring one out at home for New York City's Pegu Club, a cocktail mecca that recently shuttered its doors permanently in the wake of the pandemic. The Pegu Club's reach and importance can't be overstated, he says. To make its eponymous drink, pictured in a shaker with ice, combine 2 ounces of a lemon dry gin, the dry style gin, 3/4 of an ounce of orange curacao, 3/4 of an ounce of fresh lime juice, and 1 dash each of Angostura and orange bitters. Shake it hard for at least 10 seconds, strain into a chilled coupe glass, and garnish with a slice of lime. Number 2 is the 50-50 Freezer Martini from Houston Eves. At San Antonio's Esquire Tavern, beverage director Eves says the government's stay-at-home orders led him to appreciate the simplicity of the perfect martini. When you've been in the same hoodie for a month, you could certainly use some civility, he says. For a martini, whenever you want, empty one 750-milliliter bottle each day of navy-strength gin and dry vermouth into a large pitcher. Stir briefly and then refill the 2 bottles and place them in the freezer for at least a few hours. Pour into a chilled martini glass, express a lemon peel over the drink, and add a few olives. And 3, the Summertime Smash from Megan McClinton, a bartender at Proper, one of Fort Worth's swankiest neighborhood bars. McClinton offers up a seasonal nod to the classic whiskey smash. In a rocks glass, muddle 5 berries of any kind and 3/4 of an ounce of honey syrup. It's a 1-to-1 ratio of honey and water dissolved over low heat. Add 3/4 of an ounce of lemon juice and 1 3/4 ounces of bourbon. Cover it with crushed ice and stir lightly. Enjoy it on your back patio, porch, or balcony, McClinton says. We turn now to our cover story. This is a feature article here with the cover story, too. It's called What Lies Ahead. Various subjects here. Can renewables jumpstart the economy? Will we finally expand healthcare access? Will dating go old school? And are takeout margaritas here to stay? Pandemic has reshaped our lives in unprecedented ways, but it's not all bleak. These are a variety of pieces by a variety of writers. First up is a little sidebar type article. It's entitled Future, the Uninsured. It's by Ricardo Nuela. Will we finally expand healthcare access? He writes, I'm an internal medicine doctor at a safety net hospital in Houston, providing care to those who can't afford health insurance. We're never wanting for patients. Our state has the highest uninsured rate in the country. According to the latest census data, Nearly 18% of Texans lack health insurance. In the oil refinery town of Pasadena, southeast of Houston, 56% of adults are uninsured. These dismal numbers are due in part to our politics, namely our state government's refusal to expand Medicaid. When the Affordable Care Act was passed in 2010, states were offered a deal under the new law, expand Medicaid by enrolling residents who earn as much as 138% of the federal poverty level, as opposed to just a poverty level, a threshold that today is $26,200 a year for a family of four. And the federal government will shoulder a minimum of 90% of the costs. Participation would extend coverage to more than 1 million Texans. Texas's response? No thanks. It has its reasons. Many conservatives claim Medicaid expansion is a Trojan horse that will grossly inflate the state budget, but studies show that any new costs are offset, as uninsured patients are less likely to require expensive care in psychiatric hospitals and jails, for instance. In other words, Texas's refusal to expand Medicaid has more to do with political gamesmanship than fiscal concerns. Even before the pandemic, a 2019 survey taken by the Episcopal Health Foundation showed that nearly two-thirds of Texans favored Medicaid expansion. Now calls for expansion have grown louder. In the past, I've often resisted such rallying cries. Medicaid is a flawed program, and I've argued we should be pursuing universal coverage instead. But that was before the novel coronavirus. We're staring down the barrel of historic unemployment. More than 1 million Texans are expected to lose health insurance during the pandemic. Texas Medicaid, as it exists right now, will be able to enroll only one-third of those laid off. States that have expanded Medicaid will be able to take on more than 50%. The path ahead for the newly uninsured is financially perilous. A study published last year revealed that 58% of all personal bankruptcies in America are caused by crushing medical bills. We expect to return to business and reboot the economy in the midst of a deadly pandemic, which should assure workers that illness won't lead to their financial ruin. Solving Texas's healthcare problem is no longer about ideology. We should expand Medicaid now. Our state's prosperity depends on it. Turn now to another lengthier article here. This is also in this section of stories. It's entitled, Will Dystopian Times Inspire Utopian Art? This is by Jeff Salomon. As science fiction writers, Nikki Drayden and Christopher Brown believe that you can't create a convincing future unless you keep an eye on the present. Dystopian novels, Brown has argued, depict the world as it really is, through the refractive prism of extreme metaphor. Classics of the genre like 1984 and The Handmaid's Tale are often described as prescient, not because their authors were practicing predictive futurism as written, but because they reported accurately on the character of the contemporary world they saw. At a moment when the world is feeling awfully dystopian, we asked Drayden and Brown, both of whom live in Austin, to offer some thoughts about what's in store for us and what we might expect from science fiction to come. Drayden, a Houston native, has written four novels, the newest one, Escaping Exodus, Symbiosis, scheduled to come out in December. Brown, an Iowan who moved to Texas 2 decades ago, has published 2 books set in a dismal near future Texas. His third novel, Failed State, which he says has a more utopian bent, is due out on August 11th. Texas Monthly's first question, as people who think about the future, where do you think our current situation will take us? I'm thinking of the pandemic and the oil bust, and border strife and climate change, and the intense political divide between rural and urban Texas. If you wrap all that up, where do you think we end up 5, 10, 20, 50 years down the line? Nikki Drayden replies, we're going to have to try to become more self-sufficient. I think things are going to become hyper-local. We'll shop even more locally than we do now, and we'll be more interdependent, which I think is good. Neighbors taking care of neighbors and that sort of thing, which we've gotten away from. I think we're going to see more multi-generational homes, backyard gardens and bartering, sharing resources and pooling resources, a lot less consumerism. Hopefully there'll be more secondhand swap meets, learning how to get on with what you have, which is kind of how my grandparents lived. I think we're going to return to that sort of lifestyle where you're washing your aluminum foil and reusing it. Texas Monthly says the idea of increased self-sufficiency is very different from the predictions I've been reading that we'll see a resuscitation of the New Deal state created by FDR and extended by LBJ that's been hollowed out over the past four decades. Christopher Brown replies, creating a different role for the nation state is an issue that animates a lot of my work. You mentioned the border. I spend a lot of time around the border. And there's a good argument to be made that the main reason border walls exist is to reinforce the increasing fiction of the existence of the nation state in a world of threatened sovereignty. We've organized the world around nation states since the 1648 Treaty of Westphalia, and you can really feel that system creaking right now, which is a scary thing in a short term because it creates so much uncertainty. It leaves so many people so much more vulnerable during this period when we're between the way things have been and whatever is on the other side. To me, the most interesting thing about the pandemic is the stories I've read that suggest that at the heart of this is a local real estate problem of human beings expanding their habitat rapaciously just one bridge too far or one subdivision too far, like that project in and around Wuhan that dislodged some bats and caused the virus they were carrying crossover to humans. Solving all of these issues of thinking about our relationship with each other, thinking about our relationship with the state, about our relationship with the environment, gets back to what was the biggest surprise for me when I was writing my novels. When I set out to write Tropic of Kansas, published in 2017, I thought I was writing a work about politics and what would democracy 3.0 look like. And I ended up looking at this world that I was inventing through the eyes of my characters and realizing that in the world they lived in and the world that we live in, all of the injustices were ultimately rooted in the damaged relationship people had with the land, with the environment they live in, and with the things they do to exploit each other, to extract from that environment. I don't know how you go about hacking the agricultural revolution, the foundation of human civilization, but I think that rethinking those things along the lines of what Nikki is talking about, more community-based systems and so on, is an opportunity that the pandemic provides us. Texas Monthly's next question. I'll ask the both of you to put on your fiction writing caps and pretend you're sitting down at your desk and thinking, what can I do with the current state of affairs that might work as a speculative short story or novel? And Nikki Braden says, we're already in this new space where we have to redefine what types of problems our characters are going to have. I can see us going to the sort of situation that early cyberpunk writers like Neal Stephenson envisioned, where people are living in this kind of virtual world, and we'd be having virtual world problems where we have to redefine how we interact with each other because it gets lonely. So I think we'll see more virtual world type fictions to reflect a reality where most of us are spending more time in virtual spaces, like this Zoom call we're having right now. I don't think Zoom or any form of video chatting really does it for us. It's just very hard for your brain to reconcile that this person you'd usually be sitting in a room with, they're on this tiny screen instead. Just weird. I think it's exciting to identify those sorts of problems and see what comes out of that in future fiction. Everything is going to be very different for the children who are being raised now. This is their normal. They don't have the same references that we do. And Christopher says, I just drove 14 hours across the country through a contemporary American landscape that feels a lot like a post-apocalyptic landscape. There are things on the frontage road of I-35 that resemble something out of a Mad Max movie. Like I stopped for gas at a Shell station north of Oklahoma City, and the place looked like a location scout had been setting it up for a dystopian movie. All the shells had been moved out. There were one or two clerks, and they had masks on, and they're all behind plexiglass that looked bulletproof. There was trash everywhere, like there hadn't been anybody in there to clean in a long time. I was able to get gas, but there wasn't much else to buy. Everything you need to survive between here and there you have to carry with you. When you stop at the rest areas, people start to look a little bit like refugees in their own country. And then there's absence of traffic. I mean, driving I-35 and there's like three or four cars around you between Austin and Dallas. That's maybe the only utopian outcome of all of this. Maybe all of this is an opportunity to try to get away from the same dystopian futures that science fiction writers so often turn to and try to imagine communities of people coming together. Mr. Graydon says that science fiction writer Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower as communities going through very similar things to what we're going through now and coming together in those sorts of ways, people raising their own chickens, scavenging. When I read that book, I was taking survival notes from it. Oh, you can turn acorns into flour.
I'm like, I might need to know this. And right now in our neighborhood, there's a greenbelt area where wild onions grow. I'm like, well, if I need onions, I know where I can go to the greenbelt. And Christopher Brown says, that's awesome. It's a very science fiction writer type of thing to think. It's like the world is ending, so you pull your copy of Parable of the Sower off the shelf to use it as a manual for survivor. For Texans in particular, it's a really good opportunity as governmental systems fail to deal with the situation to try to find the right balance between that ethos of self-reliance and neighborly communities helping each other out. But we'll see. It's a lot harder to write fictions in which everybody's being nice to each other. All right, that interview was edited for clarity and length. Next up is another story from the same section, What Does the Future Hold? It's entitled Finding the Old-Fashioned Romance in the New World of Dating. It's accompanied by a little sidebar here. It's Love by the Numbers, insights from a Dallas-based match group. In April, mid-pandemic, users sent twice as many messages in Ship. It's an app to let friends swipe on your behalf as they did in February. And average daily swipes on Tinder among female Texans under 30 increased by 37% during quarantine. And when Match launched a hotline with advice for pandemic dating, 60% of the callers were men. All right, now back to our article here. This is by Sarah Hepola. The day before our first date, I told Benjamin, not his real name, that we couldn't touch. I planned to forego any hugging or casual contact. I messaged him through Hinge, sounding more like a lawyer arranging custody than a victim of the 21st century. Yeah, we have to be safe, he agreed. Before the pandemic, my pre-date disclaimer sounded more like this. No, I won't send nudes. No, I won't drive 40 minutes to the suburbs to eat at an Outback steakhouse and sleep with a near stranger. I quit drinking a decade ago, bringing an end to my boozy, reckless hookup years. And once I was in my 40s, I felt particularly out of sync with a swipe-to-match culture, wherein sex was front-loaded and often felt transactional. I was burned out by what passed for romance. I find you very attractive, a man messaged me not long ago, to be open to a friends-with-benefits situation. That was his opener. Not, how's your week, not, what are your hobbies, but, can I bone you on the regular, leave when I want, and still be buds? Then came the global pandemic. I checked Hinge in mid-March, curious to see what dating looked like in the social distancing era. I wondered if the unfolding crisis would change how we engaged. Maybe our new circumstances would make men more patient or conversations more dramatic, shaking up interactions that had become predictable and mundane. In recent years, I'd had stray thoughts like, the only thing you could save this broken dating culture is a giant asteroid. Well, one just hit. It was a weird scene. My conversations on dating apps veered between layoff anxiety and toilet paper acquisition. On the Facebook group for single women where I lurk but never participate, users whiplash between celebrating their single status and despairing over it, same as ever. Meanwhile, men accustomed to the churn of Tinder were clawing the walls. I got a text from a lab technician I'd had a few PG-13 dates with back in the old world. He immediately asked if we could have sex. When I said I thought we were better as friends, he sent a photo of a part of his body I definitely had not asked to see. What a long, tragic fall we'd taken from the days when you and your date flirted over a shared milkshake. I matched with Benjamin the second week. Cute guy, nice smile. He grew up overseas. He liked Katy Perry's Teenage Dream. I was in. He lived in a downtown condo not far from my place in East Dallas, and we decided to meet at a park nearby and walk to a restaurant offering curbside pickup. The day before our date, when I sent him the message clarifying that we couldn't touch, I felt like a bit of a prude. Being uptight is the great sin of modern dating, but I also felt blameless. Pandemic made me do it. Benjamin didn't mind. He told me not to judge him for his caveman beard. The barbershops were closed. The next night, I slid on sneakers before heading out the door, a change from the 4-inch wedges I normally wear on first dates, eager to look taller and thinner than my 5-foot-2-inch frame. But I knew we'd be walking, and I could not bear the absurdity of wobbling in heels during a pandemic. Benjamin pulled up to the park after 7. He tugged at his enormous beard as he sauntered toward me. I like your caveman look, I told him. We wandered down the sidewalk, 4 feet apart, but soon we were 3 feet apart, and then maybe 2. I felt like a prim lass in a Victorian movie, strolling an English garden with a gentleman suitor who might one day promise himself to me. I'd noticed over the years it was easier to open up when you aren't looking directly at a person, and yet all my pre-pandemic first dates took place in coffee shops where we sat across from each other enduring face-to-face combat. Those hour-long dates, more like meetings, could have a dull efficiency. My life story, followed up by your life story, and time's up. My conversation with Benjamin unfolded at a leisurely pace. Pink sunset spilled across the sky, the birds were chirping, and a late spring breeze caressed my hair in a way that had a solid chance of looking sexy. For the first time in my life, I'd shown up on a date knowing I wouldn't be physical with a man, not because I didn't like him, not because I wasn't down, not because sobriety had eliminated the psychic cost of giving away my body in the race to be some sexual adventuress. No, I would not be physical with this man because of a government mandate. It sounded dystopian, but it was also freeing. I wondered what his arms might feel like under my fingertips. I imagined the smooth skin, the taut muscle, the alternating terrain of hard and soft. It had been a long time since I'd been confined to my side of the sidewalk, but I'd been forced to wonder. Maybe it wouldn't be such a bad fate to have to get to know one another like this going forward. Early in the pandemic, people acted like we were all doomed to Zoom orgies until scientists found a vaccine. Or was it possible relationships might get better? That an out-of-control mating culture would actually benefit from a few boundaries? It's possible we might one day view the age of hookup apps before the pandemic as the boom before the bust. Maybe the swipe right carnival is over, and maybe that's not such a bad thing. I've had many conversations with young women leaking shame for things they've done in a charade of sexual empowerment and for things done to them. I've heard from young men whose numbness and estrangement after years of porn and kink spirals and random sex suggested the carnival hadn't been so free for them either. I'd spent years in sobriety feeling outdated and old-fashioned, too much work for men accustomed to sure things. In quarantine, the world had slowed to my preferred pace. Dating felt a little less lonely. A guy once told me he ditched women who didn't have sex with him by the third date. The sex by date three rule was common, but the pandemic created a new rule book. Any company was good company. Any date was a gift. Maybe it'd be good for all of us to keep limiting our options, holding one another accountable, and pay more attention to the moral weight of our decisions. Even after we'd eaten, Benjamin and I said goodbye on the sidewalk as the moon rose. Well, he began hesitantly, hands rising and falling at his sides. I knew he'd ditched the social distancing rules the second I snapped my fingers, and it was nice to have that power. Let's do this again, I said, and I began walking back to my place when he called to me. His eyes had a twinkle. You want to FaceTime when you get back, he asked. Perhaps this was the new, why come upstairs? An invitation to take our evening to the next level. Not a chance, I said, blowing him a kiss. That was a good try. The author of this, Sarah Hepola, lives in Dallas. She's the author of Blackout, Remembering the Things I Drank to Forget. And take a brief break here to remind you, you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight and Sound Broadcasting. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight and Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight into Sound Broadcasting since 1967. One more chunk of this in the future. This is Future of Oil Industry. The column is by Jeffrey Ball. It's entitled, The Mother Fracker Reckons with the Mother of All Oil Busts. One morning in mid-April, Scott Sheffield, chief executive of Pioneer Natural Resources, one of the largest oil producers in America, seated himself in a wood-paneled boardroom of his company's headquarters in Irving, gazed into his computer's camera, and begged a trio of Texas politicians for a lifeline. Over the past 2 months, oil prices had tanked 60%, effectively ending a years-long Texas boom and heralding what many in the industry were calling the mother of all busts. As an estimated 30,000 viewers around the world watched online, Sheffield beseeched the three members of the Texas Railroad Commission, the elected body that regulates the state's oil industry, to limit production in a bid he hoped would ultimately boost the global price of crude. Sheffield's message bordered on heresy. He declared that the same oil revolution that had transformed the United States from petroleum importer to exporter had brought the industry to the brink of financial ruin. It has been an economic disaster, especially the last 10 years, he said in testimony that had the feel of a key witness turning state's evidence. nobody wants to give us capital because we have all destroyed capital and created economic waste. The government didn't swoop in to save Texas oil producers from their excesses, Sheffield warned. We will disappear as an industry like the coal industry. It was a stunning admission coming from a man who had done as much as anyone to engineer a geological and geopolitical bonanza, one that now looked like a bubble. But the request for government intervention was also a characteristically strategic play for self-preservation by one of the longest-serving chieftains of the oil business, an industry that, following decades of expansion, now appears on the cusp of a slow, long-term decline. With a love of the limelight, a flair for the dramatic, and an instinct for the jugular, Sheffield, a 68-year-old native of Dallas, has had a hand in the Texas oil sector's every major swing over the past 45 years. A surge during the oil shocks of the 70s, a fall off through the 80s and 90s, and a renaissance starting in the early years of this century as the world sought massively more oil products and Texas unleashed new drilling and fracking technologies to serve up those hydrocarbons. Today, as the oil industry contracts, Sheffield is at the vanguard of a fight for market share and for survival. Sheffield took a modest family firm and ballooned it into a publicly traded behemoth, one that, before this spring's crash, was valued at $26 billion. Did it by pursuing a straightforward strategy. Drill, baby, drill. Through Republican and Democratic presidencies in peace and in war, and to the general delight of investors, Sheffield's pioneer pumped up its stock by pumping ever more West Texas crude. Blessed by profitable acreage that Pioneer and its corporate predecessor locked down decades ago when few others wanted it, and aided by aggressive lobbying in Austin and Washington, D.C., Pioneer grew to become the top driller in the Permian Basin, one of the biggest exploration and production companies in the country. By 2019, Permian accounted for almost 40% of U.S. oil production and fully 5% of the global total, an amount nearly equal to the output of Iraq, the world's sixth largest producer. But the Texas boom paralleled other seismic shifts in the international energy market, developments that pose an existential threat to petroleum. Global oil demand growth has been slowing, and investor concerns over the environmental costs of burning fossil fuels have been increasing. These twin trends have prompted a broadening consensus even among industry veterans that oil's best days are numbered. Yet until recently, Pioneer and most other Texas producers kept cranking out more and more oil, partying like it was 2005. Now the party's over. The Texas oil patch and global energy markets are knocked down this spring by what Sheffield called a double black swan event, the simultaneous arrival of a pandemic which slashed global demand, and a market share fight between petroleum giants Russia and Saudi Arabia which flooded more oil into that cratering market. Sober-minded industry insiders see that downturn as far more than another cyclical swoon. They view it as hastening a structural shriveling and consolidation that was already underway, a contraction likely to continue even though oil prices, starting in late April, began to recover. The energy sector's share of the Standard & Poor's 500, a key stock index, has tumbled from 29% in 1980 to 3% as of early June. The era of rapid growth isn't going to come back anytime soon. And probably not at all, said Bob Brackett, a former oil company executive and now an analyst at asset management firm Sanford Bernstein. Industries sometimes behave in odd ways as they move toward senescence. Oil runs in Sheffield's blood. Restraint doesn't. Born in 1952, he spent his high school years in Tehran, the Iranian capital, where his father was stationed as a U.S. petroleum executive. When it came time for college, he picked the University of Texas at Austin, intent on becoming a lawyer. But in late 1971, during his sophomore year, he got word that he had flunked out, the result of too much of everything but studying, as he recounted in a 2016 speech to the graduates of the UT Cockrell School of Engineering. To shake him up, his father shipped him off for a six-month stint on an offshore drilling rig in the Gulf of Mexico. In 1973, by which time young Sheffield had returned from rig duty to campus and switched majors from pre-law to petroleum engineering, two political events occurred that would have a profound impact on his career. That October, OPEC members imposed an oil embargo on the United States and other countries that it saw as supporting Israel in the Yom Kippur War, which had broken out earlier that month. By the time the embargo ended 5 months later, global oil prices had nearly tripled. To counteract the OPEC stranglehold, Texas called it quits on its own system of oil price support, one it had employed since the early 30s, and that had served as a blueprint for the OPEC cartel. Under the Texas system called proration, Austin had regulated the amount of oil that Texans could pump. With proration gone, Texas's oil producers were free to pump at will without the specter of a government cap. Later, Sheffield would come to find clear lessons in the events of 1973. he would need to master the intricacies of how governments shape oil markets, and would have to get savvy at bending government to his advantage. The most immediate lesson, though, was this. The Lone Star State was wide open for a young man to drill. Sheffield graduated in 1975, got a job with Cameco in Odessa. 4 years later, he became the fifth employee of Parker and Parsley Petroleum, a Midland firm founded by his father-in-law. By 1985, Sheffield was Parker and Parsley CEO. In the early 1990s and then in the mid-2000s, the company bought up oil leases on hundreds of thousands of Permian acres. "We paid nothing," Sheffield recalled during one of the interviews he and I had this spring. In 1997, he merged Parker and Parsley with Mesa Petroleum, a Dallas-based company controlled by that even more outsized Texas oilman, the late Keyboom Pickens. The goal was a heftier balance sheet, one that would work the steady eddy oil fields in the Permian as a cash machine to help bankroll the hunt for bigger oil troves around the world. "The sexy stuff," recalled Chris Cheatwood, who hired on as the firm's exploration manager. The brash new company got a brash new name, Pioneer. But after several years of exploring abroad, Pioneer returned to its home turf. The move was spurred by the advent of new technologies to coax oil out of shale, a type of rock previously thought too costly to tap. Pioneer bought up acreage in South Texas's Eagle Ford Shale before concluding that the company's Permian land had an astounding 10 billion barrels of theoretically recoverable oil lurking below. That, Keatwood recalled, was the aha moment. Sheffield raced to assemble the war chest Pioneer would need to unleash modern drilling and fracking beneath its Permian land. The company raised billions from investors in India and China and on Wall Street. Between 2010 and 2014, when U.S. oil production jumped 60% to 8.8 million barrels a day, Pioneer more than doubled its oil output to about 90,000 daily barrels. Behind the push was Sheffield's conviction that OPEC would prop up prices, enabling Texas producers such as Pioneer to profitably expand their output. "I followed OPEC closer than almost any CEO in the history of our industry," he told me. "Much of his bullishness was based on pricing set by OPEC. We made all these decisions based on $100 oil between 2010 and 2014. But the cartel came to feel cornered by the surging U.S. shale industry. In November 2014, with oil prices plummeting, OPEC refused to cut production, an attempt to call Brackett to drive shale out of business. Oil prices tanked further. So did Pioneer shares. Sheffield fought back by seeking governmental help. Along with other energy executives, he successfully lobbied Congress to lift a longtime ban on U.S. crude exports intended to minimize American dependency on foreign oil. Sheffield argued that in an era of surging Texas oil production, the ban was hurting the country and cutting into the profits of U.S. oil producers. His bravado rankled some. David Einhorn, a prominent investor shorting Pioneer stock, betting the shares would fall, argued at a conference in May 2015 that Pioneer was spending too much for its growth. He dubbed Sheffield the mother fracker. Sheffield recalled that epithet gleefully in his 2016 UT graduation speech, asserting that Einhorn had lost to a representative. Einhorn declined to comment. By the end of 2016, with Pioneer apparently in good financial shape, Sheffield retired. He moved with his wife to Fort Lightning Ranch, a 2,300-acre expanse on the Pecos River near Santa Fe that they had bought the previous year from actress Jane Fonda. The purchase price was undisclosed, but the ranch had been listed for $19.5 million. Sheffield didn't get much rest. February 2019, he returned as CEO, replacing his hand-picked successor, Tim Dove. In late 2018, oil prices had fallen, and so had Pioneer stock. Investors were chafing at Pioneer's rising corporate costs. Ominous clouds were gathering over West Texas. Before the shale boom began, predictions of peak oil had dogged the industry. The notion held that growing demand, particularly in developing countries, would exhaust global supply, sending oil prices soaring and an energy-starved economy cratering. But by the time Sheffield returned from retirement, a consensus was developing about a different sort of oil peak, a maxing out of demand, not supply. Investors were coalescing around a view that while oil would remain in demand for decades, including for the petrochemicals used to make everything from fertilizer to solar panels, growth in oil consumption had already begun to slow and would, perhaps as soon as 2030, enter a gradual permanent decline. To maintain profitability, oil producers would, much like tobacco companies, have to shift from growing their industry to managing its tail. Companies unable to do so would fail. In October 2018, a few months before Sheffield returned as CEO, Brackett, the analyst, issued a report declaring the oil industry's dotage, its title, "At Your Age." One reason for the new bearishness about oil was an unexpected bullishness about electric cars. What's left off is baubles that had begun to erode sales of conventional vehicles in some parts of the world. Sheffield told me that he has come to concur with projections that within 2 decades, electric cars will account for more than half of all auto sales. He himself has taken to driving an electric ATV around his ranch. There will be an electric car revolution, he told me. Another reason, profit-hungry institutional investors, which for decades had formed a key part of the oil industry shareholder base, increasingly fretted about climate change. They argued that carbon regulations on top of the rising economic competitiveness of electric cars and renewable energy sources such as wind and solar would make it difficult to profitably drill much of the petroleum still in the ground. The long-treasured reserves that shape oil companies' valuations, they worried, would instead become stranded assets. In March 2019, the world's biggest sovereign wealth fund, which is based in oil-rich Norway, announced it would invest its holdings in companies focused entirely on pumping more oil and gas. The fund, Pioneer's 17th largest institutional shareholder, hasn't yet sold its Pioneer shares, but Sheffield told me that it's only a matter of time. There's definitely a movement by funds around the world to move out of fossil fuels, he said, causing less capital to flow into our industry. On his return last spring, Sheffield began downshifting Pioneer for the tougher road ahead. In late 2016, not long before his brief retirement, he had set an internal target to increase the company's production by about a factor of 8 to 1 million barrels a day over about a decade. While Sheffield was gone, Dove had gone public with that goal. But Sheffield, back as CEO, repudiated those ambitions. Instead, he launched a belt-tightening program that included asset sales, layoffs, and a drastically reduced target for annual oil production growth. In hindsight, he told me the industry had added too much oil in an oversupplied market. The good times were coming to an end. Last year, Pioneer moved into its new Irving headquarters. A gleaming 10-story complex, which the company leases from an investment consortium, features shops, running trails, and fishing ponds. March 6th, a glorious spring day in North Texas, Sheffield was sitting in his top floor office when the bottom fell out of his world. That day in Vienna, 7 hours ahead of Irving, OPEC and other major oil producers, a group known as OPEC Plus, held a pivotal meeting. It did not go well. As the coronavirus threatened to stifle global demand for oil, Saudi Arabia and Russia vowed instead to ramp up production in a struggle over market share. West Texas Intermediate, the U.S. brand of crude known as WTI, fell 10% from $46 to $41 a barrel. By the following Monday, it had tumbled another 25% to $31. I knew at that point in time, Sheffield recalled, that oil was going to fall to the mid-teens at least. American producers are particularly whipsawed by swings in oil prices. Producing a barrel costs more, on average, in the States than it does in other major oil regions, notably the Middle East. Though U.S. companies vary in their costs, they typically need a WTI price of at least $22 just to avoid losing money on the wells they already operate, and as much as $55 a barrel to make sufficient returns to drill new ones, according to Brackett, the analyst. By contrast, the Saudi Arabian oil company Aramco can drill profitably with oil prices closer to $10. That's why Texas is regarded in the global oil market as a marginal producer. When prices are high, Texas rocks and rolls. When prices are low, Texas takes it in the gut. With oil prices in free fall, Sheffield gathered his top executives. They devised a two-front battle plan, shore up Pioneer's balance sheet immediately, and pushed the government to boost oil prices longer term. Job one, slash drilling while preserving cash flow. March 16th, Pioneer announced it would reduce its planned capital spending for 2020 by 45% and halve its number of drilling rigs. But it would trim actual oil production far less, only to 2019 levels, or about 12% below the 2020 target it announced before the crash. To protect itself, Pioneer went to Wall Street and bulked up on financial instruments known as hedges, widely used in the oil industry. Long and aggressive hedger, Pioneer opted for a variety that included a particularly complex type called a three-way collar. The effect of its hedges, according to Pioneer, is that the company will receive an average of $40 for each barrel of oil that it expects to produce through the end of the year, as long as Brent crude and international benchmark oil stays within a particular price range. Job two, execute a grand play of political chess intended to reinflate oil prices. Antitrust law in the U.S. bars oil companies from colluding to cut output, but there are legal ways for the government to tell us to reduce production, noted G. Wood, the Pioneer field executive. With OPEC Plus having failed to prop up prices amid the Russia-Saudi spat, Sheffield and his deputies decided they'd ask the Texas Railroad Commission to reassert the role it had played until 1973. On March 30th, Pioneer, along with partially the energy and the Austin-based oil company founded in 2008 by Sheffield's son, Brian Sheffield, submitted a request to the commission asking it to reinstate proration, Texas's old system of production limits. Under Texas law, if waste is found to exist in the oil market, the commission must address it. In the 30s, when Texas initiated proration, that waste was physical. Some Texans were dumping oil into above-ground pits so their neighbors couldn't snag it themselves from underground reservoirs. Sheffield and Parsley's chief executive, Matt Gallagher, argued that another kind of waste, economic waste, in which Texas producers were pumping beyond market demand, thus depressing prices, was just as problematic. If Texas leads the way, maybe we can get OPEC to cut production. Maybe Saudi and Russia will follow. That was our plan, Sheffield told me. I was using the tactics of OPEC Plus to get a bigger OPEC Plus done. Let's get the price of oil back in the 30s as quickly as possible. Sheffield played Washington, too. In public statements throughout March and early April, he called on President Trump to pressure OPEC Plus to curtail production. On April 2nd, Easter Sunday, following a weekend in which Trump said he'd work the phones, OPEC Plus announced a production cut of 9.7 million barrels a day. Sheffield wasn't impressed. He didn't get enough cuts, Sheffield told me. The market agreed. By Tuesday, April 14th, oil prices had fallen another 12%. That morning brought a corporate fight for the ages. Before the Texas Railroad Commission, a 129-year-old tribunal whose typical deliberations pack all the suspense of a slowly rocking pump jack, the teetering titans of the Texas oil industry faced off in a session that lasted 10.5 hours. That it occurred over the internet, thanks to the very shelter-in-place rules that had tanked global oil consumption, only added to the drama. At issue, which struggling oil companies would be helped by the state and which would be hobbled? Sheffield, beaming in from his Irving boardroom, cast himself in the role of truth-teller. He argued that only a government production cap could save an industry that was, with irresponsible abandon, sucking oil from the ground and pouring it into a saturated market. To ensure that any production cut by Texas triggered enough tightening of global oil supply to significantly push up prices, he suggested that the commission predicate proration on cuts by other U.S. states as well as foreign countries. He dismissed as self-serving blather the argument that many of his competitors had made that a production cap would violate Texas's free market principles. You have to be joking. After 35 years as a CEO, I've never seen a free market, he testified. The big companies have the worst track record in financial performance, he said. They are not efficient, and they are causing economic waste. Underlying Sheffield's argument was a question of corporate financial discipline. Some Texas oil producers took on more debt than others to finance their expansions. Pioneer, largely because it had gotten its Permian acreage years ago when it was cheap, needed to borrow relatively less than rivals that had ramped up in the Permian during frothier times. So Sheffield's call for Texas proration played to his competitive advantage. Pioneer was better positioned to ride out a potential across-the-board production cut than what Sheffield called his way over-leveraged competitors. Sheffield's rivals argued that he was just trying to get an edge. When a vocal minority takes a position in favor of artificial market manipulation that is so far removed from the consensus of a vast majority of operators, one can only surmise that their motives and objectives are primarily company-specific as opposed to broadly industry-supported, said Lee Tillman, CEO of Marathon Oil, which since mid-February had lost 63% of its market value. Other critics of Sheffield's suggested that he wanted regulators to shield him from his own gambles. They pointed out that contracts with landowners and pipeline operators typically obligate producers to pump and ship a minimum amount of oil or pay a penalty. But the contracts also usually have provisions that release producers from those obligations in the event of external factors such as government orders. James Teague, co-CEO of Enterprise Products Partners, a Houston-based company that operates pipelines and oil storage facilities, suggested, without naming Sheffield, that the Pioneer CEO and other proration supporters were seeking the commission's help to, quote, get out of some of their obligations, unquote. Texas Monthly is owned by the chairman of Enterprise Products Partners and maintains editorial independence from that company. Sheffield had vocal support from other Permian oil companies. Without government action to buoy prices, we'll set record bankruptcies in Texas, said Will Van Lowe, the CEO of Houston-based Quantum Energy Partners.
The other large players were naive to think that the oil market would recover this time as it had in prior downturns, he said. I set the tone deafness to what is really happening in the world of energy right now. In the wake of the meeting, oil prices fell even further. On April 20th, briefly but astonishingly, they turned negative. 2 weeks later, on May 5th, the Railroad Commission voted 2-1 not to hold a hearing on cutting production, effectively dismissing Sheffield's proration request. A few days before that denouement, Sheffield and I spoke. Since early January, the market had erased about $11.5 billion, or more than 40% of Pioneer's value. Like much of humanity, Sheffield had been rendered homebound. Unlike much of humanity, he was holing up in luxury. Over Zoom, I saw the vaulted ceiling of his hacienda-style New Mexico ranch house towering above him. His head was covered in a nest of gray hair that, he noted apologetically, hadn't been trimmed in 10 weeks. Alone at his computer, the man more looked like the rumpled grandfather of 11 than the hard-charging oil CEO whose compensation totaled $13.4 million last year. He noted that of the 6 oil downturns he has survived in his more than 4 decades in the oil business, half have come in just the past 11 years. The world is getting more volatile, he said. Sheffield sketched a restrained future for Pioneer, and will be operating in a slow-growing or shrinking industry. As electric car sales surge and investor concerns about climate change mount, putting more and more pressure on companies to spin off cash rather than boost production. I don't think the industry will ever get back to where they were before the crisis, Sheffield said. In May, Pioneer disclosed its first quarter results. Profits were down 17%. Spending on drilling and other capital expenditures would fall even further than the company had told investors 2 months earlier. Unlike companies shutting down most of their production, Pioneer, leaning on its hedges, was turning off only a relative handful of its wells, but it was still pulling back, saying that it planned to produce slightly less than the average 211,000 barrels per day that it sold last year. By early June, oil prices and oil company stocks, including Pioneer's, had recovered somewhat. Along with many Texas producers, OPEC Plus had continued dialing back production. But the underlying forces threatening the industry long before this spring's crash continued unabated. We're not out of the woods yet, said Sheffield, who by then had gotten a haircut. Although Pioneer wasn't trying to get out of any pipeline or pumping contracts, he said, it was exploring whether to sublease portions of its partially empty headquarters. After years of relentless growth, the biggest driller in the biggest basin in the biggest economy on the planet had a new plan for corporate success. Easy does it. The author of this piece is Jeffrey Ball, who was previously an editor and reporter in the Wall Street Journal's Dallas Bureau. He's written for such publications as Fortune, Mother Jones, and Foreign Affairs. And one more piece from What Lies Ahead. This is Future Pandemic Tech Disrupting COVID-19. Is 3 Texas innovations shaping a global response to the pandemic. First up, the $300 ventilator. When the coronavirus crisis revealed severe shortages of life-saving ventilators, a team of Rice University engineers rushed to complete a do-it-yourself version that could be built from an open-source plan for only a few $100. More than 2,800 people from 115 countries have registered to download the resulting design, which is pending emergency use authorization from the Food and Drug Administration. Mainframe Medicine is another one. Home of Frontera, the 5th most powerful supercomputer in the world, University of Texas at Austin's Texas Advanced Computing Center has become a national hub for COVID-19 data crunching. Among the work being done by the TACC, testing a computer model of the virus, which could aid in designing treatments and vaccines. And a peel-and-stick vaccine. COVID-19 won't be eradicated until a vaccine is produced and distributed across the globe, but properly storing vaccines and sending them to developing nations can be tricky. At our UT Austin pharmaceutics professor, Maria Croyle, who has devised a peelable, lightweight film that can preserve vaccines, costs little to ship and can withstand extreme temperatures. The film dissolves inside patients' mouths. This was put together by Jason Hyde and Peter Holly, and it brings us to the end of our reading for today. You've been listening. Texas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30.
For a fun break from the heavy news of the day, we'd like to invite you to join us for the Lifestyle Show. This program is made up of fun features from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American.
Simple composting for simple gardeners.
Bon appetit. Chef struck by Eoff's dream for downtown Odessa.
Consider music to help foster plant growth.
West Texas artist creates frying pan fire for ENAM.
Owners of Miss Casey's honored by BPW.
Music minister seeks to unify people.
Museum of the Big Bend completes video touchscreen upgrades.
Walk on the wild side. First grade teacher loves the wildlife.
USS Texas Battleship soon will have a new home by Tumbleweed Smith.
Hints from Heloise. Don't store apples, carrot in same crisper drawer.
Master gardeners tips for succulent care.
The Lifestyle Show. Friday mornings at 6 and repeated Sunday nights at 7:30 and Thursdays at 4:30 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 89 and partly cloudy. Mostly cloudy tonight with a low in the upper 70s. Then tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high in the low 90s. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McClamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight and Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the July issue of Texas Highways. And since it's the first of the month, I will read the editor's note that gives an indication of what the issue is about. After nearly 3 months cooped up at home without traveling much further than our local grocery stores, our staff is looking forward to future trips to some of our favorite Texas spots, as well as exploring new ones. The first time I saw this month's cover photo of the crystal-clear Nueces River, I immediately added it to the top of our month family's bucket list. After you finished reading writer-at-large Joe Nick Potoski's excellent portrait of the river and its environs, starting on page 44, I'm betting you'll want to add it to yours, too. Here's where some of our other staff members are setting their sights. Tyson Bird, Digital Strategies Manager. I'm looking forward to visiting a region of Texas I've spent very little time in, but have always wanted to explore, the Panhandle. As a frequent visitor and volunteer in Texas state parks, I've long wanted to camp in Caprock Canyons in Palo Duro. Julia Jones, Assistant Editor. When I can, I'll be heading into the wilderness of the Piney Woods with a novel, a hammock, and some binoculars. Hiking through the pines in Sam Houston National Forest is the most engaged my senses have ever been. The air is different in East Texas. There's nothing like it. Matt Joyce, Senior Managing Editor. Having been largely deprived of camping during our lovely springtime, I jumped when the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department reopened its camping reservation system in late May. Scouring the department's website, I lucked out and found open sites in the coming weeks at three family favorites: Lost Maples, Kickapoo Caverns, and the Davis Mountains. Saddle up. Natalie Moore, Product and Engagement Manager. I've always been into rock climbing. In college, I was an instructor at a summer camp. Our April 2020 issue inspired me to plan a trip out to Huecotanks State Park one day. Bouldering is not my strong suit, but I'm willing to give it a shot. What Texas destinations are you most looking forward to visiting again or for the first time? Send us an email at letters@texashighways.com and let us know. And that was written by Emily Roberts Stone, the editor-in-chief. And now I will read this month's feature article, In Search of Half-Forgotten Rivers, by Michael Barnes and Joe Starr. A mission to trace Texas's major rivers leads to a discovery of two waterways that hold plenty of history and beauty, despite flowing under the radar. After gushing up from cold springs, the James River's crystal-clear waters wind through a narrow, verdant canyon before joining the Llano River at a shoal of smooth stones just south of Mason. Further north, the Peace River runs in ribbons from the Caprock through grass-tufted mesas and across pebbled limestone beds. Near its mouth at the Red River in Vernon, it bends around muddy pastures covered with tall grasses and big trees. The James and the Peas, no matter how lovely, remain largely unvisited. There are a few points of entry, making them difficult to access. During trips in 2016 and 2019, we, Michael Barnes, a longtime columnist for the Austin American Statesman, and Joe Starr, an English as a second language professor at Houston Community College, hardly saw anyone on their banks. In fact, when we started tracing Texas rivers a decade ago, we had never even heard of the James and the Peas. The two of us came up with a term for these rivers, half-forgotten. Few seem to know of their existence, and those who don't visit them often. So, they sit isolated, hidden, and relatively untouched by human interaction. In seeking out the James and the Peas rivers over the course of 10 years, we came to learn a lot about their distinct characteristics. We got to know each other in college 45 years ago and have been road trip buddies ever since. By the early 2000s, we had traveled across almost the entire lower 48 by car, van, and truck, visiting parks, monuments, museums, and whatever else the road happened to throw our way. Our shared urge to trace Texas rivers started out as a hankering for space. As Texans living in urban areas, we longed for a stretch of road with no cars in sight. In 2003, we decided to track the route of the Lewis and Clark expedition from Camp Dubois in Hartford, Illinois, all the way to Fort Clatskop, Oregon. Like the early explorers, we followed the rivers. A few years after that, standing on Bryan Beach at the mouth of the Brazos River near Freeport, it hit us. What if we traced every major river in Texas? We read a couple dozen books about those rivers, then crisscrossed the countryside. We documented our hikes to the rivers, visited scores of parks, sampled hundreds of local eateries, photographed a great many courthouses, and stopped at just about every historical marker along the way. We blogged about our adventures for the Austin American Statesman. We were careful not to trespass on private property and stuck to riverbeds, which are fair game according to navigation rights published by Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We started out with paper maps, including some that were very detailed and, at the time, expensive, published by the U.S. Geological Survey. Through the 50 river tracing road trips that took us down from the mountains, through the deserts and hills, across the prairies and forests, and in some cases, right down to the Gulf Shore, we got to know Texas a little better. Even though it sometimes feels like we've barely scratched the surface of the state, seeking out new-to-us corners of natural beauty with tangible connections of past to present endeared us even more to the place we call home. The James. Called the Unknown River of Central Texas by nonprofit advocacy group, the Environmental Defense Fund, the James is the only major tributary of the Llano if you don't count the North Llano and the South Llano. The latter join neatly in the aptly named town of Junction. The James, meanwhile, begins in Kimball County and continues northeast to meet the Llano near Mason. The James-Llano system suffered major floods in June 1935, September 1980, and October 2018. Perhaps that's why there are so few structures or mature trees along the river or James River Road, which follows the low canyon for much of its length. In 2019, on our second visit, we started at the true headwaters of the James, located on private land. There, Russell Rogus looked out over the low, smooth, tilted canyon. "After the big floods, just about everything you see had changed," said Russell, a Brenham resident whose family owns the land surrounding the headwaters in Kimball County. "That boulder was over here. This pond was over there." His father-in-law, Larry Tiegler, purchased the terraced valley on Ranch Road 479 between Harper and Junction, quote, "for the view and the water," which are ardently enjoyed by Russell, his wife, Amy Rogus, and their four outdoorsy sons. The Rogus family has survived epic floods, wildfires, and 3 years ago, a tornado that somehow did not damage what remains of the Creed Taylor Ranch home. A historical marker notes it was once dubbed, quote, "the finest home west of San Antonio." It burned down in 1926 and again in 1956. A single-story house now sits on the 19th-century foundation. "We just come and relax," Russell said. "In this world where everything goes on, this is a nice respite for the boys." His sons, Britt, 18, twins, Ben and Grant, 16, and Jack, 11, are all over these highlands in ATVs, Russell said. That morning, Jack had killed a hog, and the boys estimate they shoot 15 feral hogs a month on the land during the summer. They invited us to sift through the remains of a Native American midden littered with chert that rises slightly above the clear, cold first waters of the James. "There are springs all through here," Amy said. "In the summer, you can hear it. It sounds like a bathtub with the faucet on full." Below this spot, the casual visitor comes in direct contact with the James and its shorter tributary, the Little Devil's River, at only a few spots along RR 479 and RR 385. Travelers can also see the James by taking the granite gravel James River Road, which shadows the lower James until it converges with the Llano River near RR 2389 in Mason County. Yet, there are plenty of sites along the way, including an especially helpful historical marker that explains how a Spanish expedition in 1808 forged through these canyons on the way to Santa Fe, New Mexico. We stopped in the dry bed as the river road crossed recharge zones. There, we marveled at the stratified rock canyon walls and the pools of water teeming with tiny sunfish and Guadalupe bass. The angler's paradise would not have gone unnoticed by practiced fishermen, such as Reverend authors Fred Gibson and John Graves, revered authors Fred Gibson and John Graves, who wrote poignantly.